Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Sprint Podcast. This is the penultimate episode of this season, which is focusing on the 2001 World Rally Championship. And as promised, we have 2001 World Rally Champion Robert Reid joining us as a guest. So some great tales in store there over the next 2 hours or so. So really hope you enjoy them. Next week will be the final episode of the series, where we'll just do a bit of a season recap and a bit of a recap on, I suppose, how things went for ourselves with the first series of the podcast, and kind of a where they know for the drivers and all that kind of stuff, as well as a bit of a preview for series two, which will be coming up pretty soon as well. So be sure and check that out. Once again, thanks to everyone for tuning in over the last while. We've really been blown away by your responses, and just it means an awful lot to us. So thank you very much, and we'll keep providing content for you to enjoy. So. Anyway, enjoy this episode with Robert Reid, and we'll talk to you next week. So with me we have 2001 World Rally Champion Robert Reid. Welcome along, Robert.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So Robert, for this podcast, obviously focused on the 2001 season, you were, one of the most important players in the championship. Can you just, before we get into that side of things, can you just give us a little bit of a brief intro into the early part of your career and how you kind of got to this level?
Yeah, I mean, like everyone, it was sort of local car club, kind of enthusiastic amateur, always wanted to get involved. And I'm from a farming family, and my dad had a couple of farms, and in between the two of them, or on the road between the two of them, is Craigvinion Forest in Perthshire. And the story is that when I was about 9 years old, we were travelling between the two farms one Sunday afternoon, and there were some rally cars. And I insisted, I think quite emphatically, that we stop. And we went and watched, and it was a Scottish rally. So it was sort of tail end of Mark 1s, beginning of Mark 2 escorts. And again, the story goes that we stood there and I refused to leave until like 20 minutes after the last car had gone through. And from then on, it was, I was kind of hooked on it. So you then kind of fast forward to getting your driving license, because in those days there was no junior rally, no opportunity to do stuff before you were 17. So really it was a case of get your driving license, go to the local car club, which for me was 55 car club in Perth, in Scotland. So went along there, did a bit of the usual club stuff, a bit of driving, a bit of navigating on navigational events, 12 cars, bit of auto testing, sprints, hill climbs, the whole thing. And I suppose I was pretty good at the navigating bit. I tried the driving bit, I wasn't so successful, but I was pretty good at the navigating bit. And that led to doing quite a lot of road events at the time, and ultimately on to doing stage events. Then I suppose Scottish Championship, did a couple of years with Robbie Head in Novas, did National Championship. Robbie went on and got an opportunity with Evans Halshaw in the Group N Sierra. And I didn't get the opportunity at the time, which kind of really annoyed me and motivated me at the same time. And the reason that was given for me not getting the opportunity is that I didn't have any pace note experience. So obviously all the rallying we're doing at that point was on maps, Scottish Championship, National Championship, I'd done a couple of Manx Nationals and that was it. So the next year, I did a season with Stephen Price, cross doing Irish tarmac and some of the British Championship rounds, because it gave me the opportunity to broaden my horizons a bit and also get a lot more experience on pace notes. So kind of filling in that gap that had been a criticism, as it were, of me at that point. And then end of the year with Stephen, I was in one of the fields on the farm, and the phone rang one day, and it was McRae on the phone. It was Colin, and he's like, fancy doing the Hackle this weekend, which was my local rally in Scotland, 55 Car Club Rally. So we went and did the Hackle and we won it. And then I did Galloway Hills with Alistair 6 weeks later. And then in the interim, I'd done as a one-off the Audi Sport Rally with Steve Eggleston. And we were beaten by a young red-headed English guy called Richard Burns. And got speaking to him in the bar afterwards. And we were kind of talking about doing something the next year. And I was kind of playing hard to get because I was the one that had some experience. And he didn't really have any experience at the time. And so within a 12-week period, I'd done a rally with Colin, done a rally with Alistair, and then did my first rally with Richard.
Like looking at the guys you mentioned, Robbie Head as well as the McRae brothers and Richard, obviously. Was there a particular reason why there was such a level of talent up and coming in the UK at the time, and Scotland especially when you look at it?
Yeah, I don't really know. I mean, obviously in 91 we had the Shell Scholarship, and if you look at the guys there, so Robbie, Richard, Alistair, Mark Higgins, Johnny Milner and Domi Buckley. Now, I mean, that was phenomenal amount of talent at that point, all to be coming through and all to be at that same point at the same year. So I don't really know what it was about it. I mean, I kind of like to think that there was an ethos at that time that you cut your teeth in a class car. So it was 1.3 Novas was where most of us kind of came from. Obviously, Richard Persia Challenge kind of as it went on from there. So I think there was an opportunity, whereas now it seems more difficult to get your name known now because there's not that same class car opportunity, you know, and people are arguably getting into bigger cars too quickly, which means that, you know, invariably they haven't got enough money to run them and it's harder to make a name. So I don't know, I mean, that's maybe just a coincidence that was happening at that time, but it's certainly a bit of rallying that I think is missed at the moment.
No, absolutely. And as you say, like the one make series and those kind of things were definitely a great asset for talent at the time. Looking then, we'll say, as you and Richard kind of progressed into Group A cars with the Legacy, you know, the AA cars and on into your first period with Subaru and then onto Mitsubishi. Can you just take us through some of the, I suppose, the stories from that time as well?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it's kind of right place, right time in some degree. You know, we won 91. I started with Richard. He'd obviously won the Persia Challenge national section the year before. For 91, the national and international was amalgamated all into one. He was pestering me to do the championship, and I said I'd do the first round and see how it went. And we went to the YD and it was snowy, and we came off the first stage, and he said, "What do you think of that then?" I said, "Well, it's okay. It's pretty average, really." I think we were like fifth or sixth fastest. And I regretted those words in the next stage because we caught and passed Brendan Creeley in 3 miles on a 1 minute start. It was still snowy and icy. We were going sideways through gates in fifth gear in a Group N Peugeot. And, you know, I obviously pushed a button somewhere and he wanted to prove a point. And it just kind of went on from there. I think it was a 13-round championship. We won it after 7 rounds. And, you know, there was loads of events I'd not done before. I mean, we went to Antibes in Belgium, for example, was one of the rounds. And by kind of midway through the year, we'd won it and we'd wrapped it up. So, you know, it was great to do that. But then you're sitting there thinking, why is the phone not ringing? You know, why do people not want to employ us in a factory car? And, you know, there's this illusion that that the phone's going to ring and it's all going to be easy and somebody's going to pay you a load of cash to go and have some fun and crash a few cars. And it's not like that. You know, it's all a lot of hard work. And we got a couple of opportunities with Des Adele at the time. There was a Group N 16-valve 309 that he was developing. So we did a couple of rallies in that. We did the REC at the end of the year as a prize drive in the Group E 16-valve car. And I think that was a kind of the first opportunity against kind of known talent. You know, Dave Metcalf was still about at that point. We were in the same class as him, you know, setting comparable times. So it was great to get in a proper factory car. And then obviously that led on to Group N car in the national championship. And again, that was just kind of right place, right time. So the guy who was Richard's mentor, or I suppose both of ours from then on, a guy called David Williams, was doing some rallying. And Wills had bought Group N Legacy of ProDrive. And I don't quite know how it came about, but we ended up using it anyway on the national championship because the phone hadn't rung. So we ended up doing national championship, won that. I think we were the first people to win a national event in the UK outright in a Group N car. Had a couple of seconds. And I mean, it was again against really good people. You know, he had really good drivers like Murray Grierson in his Metro, Trevor Smith, some of these guys. So, you know, it was a tough old proving ground. You know, we had to go pretty hard. And the car, the Group N car, is still in Richard's collection. You look at it now and you would not believe it. Compared with Group N cars that we know from, you know, 5 years ago, whenever it was still about. I mean, this thing is literally a standard road car. You know, back seat in it, you know, everything. It just literally looks like standard road car. And then that led to, an opportunity. We our sponsor, LNX, who'd been with us through Peugeot Challenge and Group N car, we persuaded them to support us in going to British Championship in a Group A car. And we had a couple of options. We had an option of an Escort with Steve Black, SBG Sport, or we were talking to ProDrive, because obviously Colin had done 2 years British Championship and then moved on. And we went to have a meeting with DR, and we actually went to tell them we were taking the deal with Steve Black, because it was less money and we didn't have enough money for what ProDrive wanted. So we sat in the office with DR and me, Wilsey and Richard, and David's kind of doing all the talking. He's like, we've been trying to work out our plans and, you know, unfortunately we're here to tell you that we're going elsewhere. And DR's like, what? Well, I thought you were going to come and drive with us. He said, well, we want to, but we don't have enough money. He said, how much have you got? I can't remember the figures now, but so we told him what the other deal was. And he said, okay, give me 5 minutes. He went out of the office and he came back in and he said, if I match it, will you come and drive for us? So we ended up in the Group A car and the LNX car, and obviously went on and won the championship. But the funny bit for me, well, it was actually quite stressful, is we went to do a test. So obviously Alistair then came on board and we were to share the livery and all the rest. And we went to do the first test and we were banned under pain of like not doing the championship, no stopwatches. So we weren't allowed to test. And it was a loop. So you went up a bit of road, past the log pile conveniently, round a loop and then came back down the same bit of road past the log pile. So I spent the whole day with both hands behind my back, like secretly timing. And everybody was like, oh, Alice is going to blow you guys away. Or, you know, it's hardly going to be worth you turning up. You know, oh, I watched Alistair and he was much quicker. And Wilsey kept coming across to me. He just kept sidling across going, what are the times? And I said, how's it look? He said, Alistair looked amazing coming in sight in that last corner. like big sideways and lots of revs and everything. And I was telling him the times, and he's just like chuckling. He's like walking away going, ah, because we were quite a bit quicker over that piece of road. So it came to Vauxhall Rally of Wales, or Rally of Wales, can't remember if it was Vauxhall sponsored that year or not. And right enough, we were fastest on the first stage against Alistair and Malcolm, neither of whom liked it, surprisingly enough.
That Group A legacy kind of sticks in our minds. It was obviously a very successful car over here in the hands of Bertie Fisher, and you obviously would have been competing against Bertie in some rounds as well. You mentioned the Group N car. What was the step up like to the Group A car like for you guys, considering that this was the era where, you know, they had the bigger restrictors and that kind of stuff?
Yeah, massive. I think I'm right in saying that ProDrive always said the car that we drove on the 93 GB was the most powerful legacy Group A engine they built, because that was right at the end of the 38mm restrictor. I mean, you know, they were awesome cars, whether you're competing in them or spectating or whatever. You know, and I think it's something we miss today. The cars today, okay, they're very precise. But, you know, those cars were really raw, agricultural, you know, lock rear diffs, all the rest. And I remember, you know, Richard and Alistair sitting in Park Fermi in the morning of a rally. Just if you revved them up slowly and then backed off, they would like, bang! And it was just amazing, you know, hairs in the back of your neck standing up stuff. But again, you know, as a co-driver, amazing car, great car. And lots of people talk about Manta 400s as being like really nice cars to be in, comfortable cars. Unfortunately, I never competed in one. But I think for me, Legacy is probably similar, because you had some space about you. You had some room. You weren't cramped in. You know, if we fast forward 15 years or 10 years, whenever it was, you know, 206, I mean, tiny inside. Whereas Legacy was like fantastic. Just felt right. It was, you know, amazing car. Whereas the Group N car, you're always protecting the car. You're always worried the brakes were going to go, or you're going to break a gearbox or something. And all of a sudden you were in a car that you could drive. But then again, you know, just as we thought win the Porsche Challenge and get a phone call and get a works drive, you think get in a works car and it's totally unbreakable, and any problem you have, they've got spare parts and it'll all be fantastic. And it doesn't quite work like that either. So all these illusions are being shattered as you go through as well, just as to what it actually is like. And it's interesting you mentioned Bertie, you know, great driver and great person. And actually when I was doing, when Robbie and I did Ulster in 89, we actually went and stayed with Bertie on the recce, and then stayed with Brian and Liz Patterson during the rally. And Bertie paid the entry on the rally for us, because we didn't have the budget to do it. So, you know, knew Bertie quite well, kind of through that. And always remember the day of the accident, because we all got off the aeroplane from Monte Carlo, got off at Heathrow, for me to get a plane up to Edinburgh, and got off the plane and everybody's phone started ringing and everything. And I just saw Malcolm and he was like as white as a sheet. I said, "You okay?" He said, "Bertie's helicopter's gone down." So, yeah, I always remember that day.
Very, very sad time for Australia, obviously. And you and Bertie, you and Richard and Bertie and Rory would have had great battles in the series that year. So, obviously, you won out the overall British Championship that year, and then moved on to kind of, I suppose, the Works 555 Subaru team for the subsequent years, you know, between selected world rounds and the Asia Pacific and things. Can you talk us through some of that?
Yeah, I mean, that British Championship year was good, and the only low point was Ireland and Ulster. I mean, it was the only event we didn't win, but not only did we not win it, but we managed to crash quite early on. And I don't know what was up. It was just a disaster from start to finish. The recce didn't go well. Conditions didn't suit. Didn't have a good test beforehand. Couldn't get to grips with the car. Couldn't get a setup. I don't know. I mean, it was just, you know, to have won four British, or three at that point, but to go on and win four British Championship rounds, have a reasonable run to seventh on Rally GB, on the REC, and then all of a sudden, you know, in the middle of that, you've got one event that just didn't work. I have no idea what it was. Ulster's not been kind to me over the years. I was through a hedge with Robbie. I was into a big boulder with Stephen Price. One of these big things that stops you falling into the lake. Off in a bog with Richard. So it's not been the kindest place for me, I'm afraid. But yeah, Rally GB was the last event. Difficult because it was snowy. Quite a tough Rally GB. And at the end of GB, we didn't know what was going to happen. And John Spiller, the team manager, took us to one side at the end of GB and said, right, guys, you're off to Thailand in a week's time to do Rally of Thailand. And that was, you know, that was the start of it, as it were. So we went off to Thailand, and it ended up with Richard in jail during the recce for knocking a guy off his motorbike on one of the stages, who was completely on the wrong side of the road. And me having to get on the back of a motorbike with a Thai guy to go to the only telephone in the village to try and get hold of Spiller to say, you need to help us here, because it was all looking not very good. And then ending up sitting in the back of a pickup truck for like 4 hours to get from this village back to Bangkok. And it was right at the end of the recce. We'd done all the stages, thankfully. So we had all the notes and everything. Yeah. And then, so we arrived back, and the first thing, we got a bollocking from Spiller because the press conference and press event was starting in 5 minutes. And we had to go and get our proper kit on and go to that. So it was all a real whirlwind. And I mean, Asia Pacific at that point was like the Wild West. I mean, there was cars coming towards you on stages. There was cows on the road. I mean, it was dangerous. And you had, you know, you had Possum and Kenneth Erickson and Tommy at times, and Colin at times, Ari did a couple of events as well. So you had a lot of good drivers there, and you had to go pretty quick. But you just never knew what the next surprise was going to be.
You guys had some successes over there, including the win in New Zealand in 96 in the Mitsubishi, wasn't it? Did you feel that experience kind of, you know, helped you in your, I suppose, formative years in the WRC? Like, when you look at your stage times from, say, 97 on and 98, you could see that, you know, even though Richard's style was a lot different to other drivers, that the pace was really starting to build up and you were becoming a major threat, culminating obviously in the two wins in 98. Do you think that experience helped you in that regard?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's about, you know, in talent development terms that I'm involved in now, we talk about literacy, you know, and whether that's vocal literacy or physical literacy, or it's about learning new things. It's about being adaptable. And that definitely taught you to be adaptable. It's just, you know, it's a pity. A lot of people say to me, I'm maybe stealing one of your questions to come. A lot of people say, have you got any regrets? And my answer would be, no, I've got no regrets. However, there's a couple of things I kind of wonder how it might turn out otherwise. And I think with Asia Pacific, it would have been nice to win an Asian Asia Pacific round. We came close in Thailand a couple of times, you know, various other rallies, and just didn't quite manage to piece it together, both in Subaru, but then also in Mitsubishi as well. And we had an interesting accident in Mitsubishi There was a stage, I think they all called it the mountain stage. And we went off the road. It's on YouTube, as all these things are now. Went off the road and rolled down this bank. And we came to rest. And the foot plate in front of my feet was horizontal. So I was basically standing on the foot plate. So I released my belts and I was stood up on the foot plate, on the footrest. So anyway, we came to rest. And Richard said what he always said. And I said, "You okay?" I'm like, "Yeah, you okay?" He's like, "Yeah." And then I went to put time card away or something. And I looked around, he's gone. I'm like, "What's going on here?" And he was literally out of the car. So I got out of the car, got back up to the road. And he's like, the snakes in there. It's about to be snakes. And he's like, "I've read that if you make a noise, you disturb them. But as soon as the noise goes away, they come back again." And I'm like, "Okay. You need to go back down at the car and you need to radio the team to tell them that we've crashed. I'm not going down there." There's some expletives as well. "I'm not going down." So eventually I had to go back down in the car to radio the team and tell them that we've gone off the road. So he definitely was due me for that one for a long time. That was a pretty interesting one. But yeah, then New Zealand was New Zealand was amazing. I mean, Kenneth was there in the Subaru. Tommy was there as our teammate in Mitsubishi. Again, you know, it was a good field of drivers. I think it was Possum and Kenneth, Tommy and ourselves. And we controlled it well, played a good tactical game, which Richard was always good at, like New Zealand, went on and won it. And it's the only event that we've won where we had two winning parties on the same night afterwards. Because in the Sunday night in Auckland, we partied pretty hard. And then Richard, myself, Simon Davison and Beef, Michael Park, Simon and Beef were doing gravel notes for us, got on a plane and we stopped off in Hawaii for a couple of days holiday. So we left Auckland on the Monday morning and arrived in Hawaii on the Sunday afternoon, just the way the time difference worked. So it's quite novel to get absolutely smashed twice in the same night in a different continent. But and you know, moving on from there, the confidence was growing. I mean, the Mitsubishi was a tricky car, certainly for Richard. You know, it was very much a Tommy car. And we tried initially to change it and then realized that actually that would be quite difficult and that we should change ourselves and change the way we approached and the way Richard drove. And I think that was a real turning point because, again, just having that adaptability and being able to change. And then, so that was the Evo 3 at New Zealand time. And then 4 and then ultimately 5 by the time we finished with Mitsubishi was, it wasn't easy. It was quite tough. We finished second in Safari in 97 and then won in 98. That was a big party as well. There's a bit of a theme developing here, you see, with the wins. And then we had obviously led GB and got a puncture 97 and then went on and won in 98. But 98, that 2 or 3 week period was a real blur because we'd come from Australia and literally we got back from Australia on the Tuesday or Wednesday or something, did a test and then started the recce the following Monday because it was only 2 weeks apart. But in Australia, we rolled twice on the event, second time terminal. So first time we clipped a tree in the inside of a corner and rolled, got back in our wheels, continued. And second time went off into the trees at too high speed to even consider and destroyed it. And then we came back and rolled again on the GB test at the weekend. So we rolled 3 times in a week. And then went on. So I think Richard said to Andrew Cowan before the event, he said, I know I've been a bit expensive in the last week, but believe me, I'm going to win this event for you. And then we went out and won it.
It was a big shame that you didn't win in 97. You obviously had the pace and that stunning drive on Radnor in the fog, which kind of leads us nicely into one of our next questions. Just like the pace knots, like it's such a obviously important aspect, but Richard's notes seem to be far ahead of what anyone else was using at the time, and it definitely aided his driving style as well, which again was, you know, far ahead of its time. If you want to look at it, it's the way the cars and drivers have gone subsequently. Can you just give us a little bit of insight into how that developed and how you tweaked it as time went along?
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I certainly believe that he was ahead of his time. In the effort he put in and the amount of preparation, and the notes can show that. So we had 28 different severities of corner. Now, at the time, Colin had 6. So, you know, there was a lot in that. But, I mean, I remember the first GB we did, we had, and you know, it kind of shows you how the notes evolve. And you always borrow things from other people. And Richard's pace note system, unlike a lot of people at the time, was kind of based on the original Jimmy McRae type system, ironically. So descriptive system, starting with absolute, you know, absolute flat, easy, fast, medium, K, 90. You know, that was the basis of the system. But I remember a bit, I can't remember what stage it was in, but in the Group A, 309 and GB, I mean, it was absolutely impossible to call absolute left and absolute right and absolute left and absolute right on all the quick stuff. And we're like, we need to change that. So then we changed the absolute to max because it was much easier to say. And I think that was a Malcolm one. I think that's where we borrowed that one from. And then Richard realized that having absolute and flat wasn't enough definition for him. So he added slight in. So slight was, you know, literally a straight, but you just could see a corner on it. And what that did, it wasn't really a speed pace note, but it allowed you to define the road much better at the high speed. So rather than, you know, if you had absolutes and flats, you were kind of waiting till you got to it to know that you were at it. Whereas adding slight in and keep left, keep right, you could actually start to really describe the high speed. And then we had flat plus, flat minus, and slow flat, which always sounded a bit strange. But ultimately a flat wasn't even flat. So it was just the definition. So we ended up with slow fasts as well, I think. With slow fast right as well, and left. So we ended up with all these different notes. But it wasn't just that. It was the way Richard's mind saw the corners, because he had all these different calls, but then he saw it quite like a racing driver would see it. So approach, you know, braking phase, as it were, approach, brake, apex one, apex two, exit, and sort like that. So we'd have things in our notes, you know, we might have, I'll think of an example. So fast right and easy right. Other people might have fast right opens, but for Richard, he wanted to know what it opened to. So you might say fast right opens to easy right. But for Richard, in the way his mind worked, it was actually kind of two apexes. So it was just fast right and easy right. And then as this was all developing, I started, because it was a real pain when the notes constantly evolve. So if you imagine you're writing pace notes as you normally would in rows, so 5 rows in a page or whatever, and you know, you'd made the note, say it's fast right, 40, you know, medium left, whatever it was. And then you come the next time and he says, that fast right, make it a fast right and easy right and flat right. And you're like, shit, how do I squeeze that into that line? It was really hard to do. So I started writing my notes in two columns. And there weren't many. Fabrizia Pons, that's where I saw it. Fabrizia wrote in two columns. But it was much easier with eight things in a column, one side, the other side, to thumb down one side, thumb down the other, have your finger, you know, behind the next page. So it kind of gave you a bit of security in terms of where you were. And it was much easier to expand or contract the notes. Because again, if we'd been making the notes and it was 40 fast right and easy right, 60, you know, as well as add something in, he might come the next time and say, take that easy right out. So again, if you're doing it in rows, you end up with a whole load at the start of the row and a big space where you've rubbed stuff out and then something at the end of the row. And it was just a nightmare to manage. So the columns idea was a much better way of managing that. So I think, you know, not only did we develop, or did Richard develop this complex pace note system, but I also developed a way of managing that and handling that a lot better. And, you know, the frustration always as a co-driver is whenever the driver decides to change something or use another call, it takes a whole year to go through that, because you go through every event and you've got a year of pain to change things on a year's worth of notes. And you'd be in the last event of that year, you'd be thinking, oh, just one more event, then it'll be a bit easier and I'll not have to stay up till 3 o'clock in the morning rewriting notes and whatever. And then he'd come to the rec and he'd go, I've been thinking, not again. And then we'd change something else. So, I mean, literally up to the day that we stopped, we were changing things. So it wasn't as if it was just evolved and that was it. You know, there was a whole amount of effort went into into the whole process. And the interesting thing with the two columns on the notes is that at the time Beef was doing gravel notes for us, and so he started doing his notes in two columns, and then Steve Turvey took over when Beef went and was co-driving more. Steve Turvey took over doing the notes, and to begin with he really struggled with the notes, and then he was competing and still doing a bit with Mark Lovell out in America at the time. And Turv started writing his notes in two columns. And then when I got involved, someone will probably come to in a bit in terms of development schemes with MSA and everything, Seb Marshall and Scott Martin, both also did their notes in columns because they saw what I was doing. I explained to them and they're like, oh, we'll try that in a test. So now there's a little kind of enclave of people that have been influenced over the years that do the notes in that way.
That's fascinating stuff. Like watching some of your onboards from the time, and it's, I think the one that does a full stage four actually in the network queue the year you won the title, and you can actually see where you pass Colin's car on the side of the road about a third of the way into the stage. But trying to, even just watching it on YouTube and trying to paint the picture of the road, if you just watch it with your eyes closed, Richard's and your notes, you can get a much better kind of flow, I suppose, of how the road is kind of coming up. And that probably explains an awful lot as to how he could drive the car a lot straighter because he knew what was coming, and why he explains a lot why the two of you were so phenomenally quick in fog, you know, because he knew what was coming, whereas as you mentioned, Colin's notes were, you know, he'd six gradients for a corner and that was it. He was driving a lot more in sight. So just with Richard's driving style, obviously the Mitsubishi was a tricky car to drive. Only Tommy and yourselves really got on top of it. Freddie struggled massively in it in the years to come after you guys joined Subaru. Did you have a lot of influence, we'll say, in the likes of the P2000, which was, you know, one of Richard's, I suppose, favourite cars from the time. Did your driving styles sort of influence the development of that car in a big way?
Yeah, they did. And just to finish off on the pace notes thing, we Monte Carlo, I can't remember what year it was, but in Monte we often had two gravel crews. So we had Simon Davison and Beef, and then we had Di Llewellyn and Ian Grinrod as a second crew. But in order to split the experience up, we had Simon with Grinny and Di with Beef. And Ian Grinrod could not get on with the notes at all. Just Simon said it was a nightmare. He'd be reading something and he'd go, oh, he's got it wrong. He's got a left for a right again. Because when I had fast right and easy right, he'd be like, well, you only have one corner going one way. So the second one must be a left. And Simon said they took like half an hour to get a few Ks in the first stage for Ian to get his head round it. And still, if I see Ian today, he's like, I don't know how you ever managed to read those notes. But, you know, it just shows how personal notes are for individuals. You know, it wasn't that they were good, bad, or indifferent. It was they worked, and they worked for Richard, and they gave him the confidence that he needed in order to drive. And I think, you know, it also reflects back. I mean, against Alistair in the British Championship, if a stage was on the map, then we were generally quicker. If there was a stage that wasn't on the map and we were driving more blind, often Alistair was quicker. You know, Richard wasn't keen on driving blind. He liked to know where he was going. He liked lots of information. And as you say, I mean, I think that's right. And it comes through to cars later on and to the way Richard was able to drive them, which was a lot straighter than most people were doing at the time. You know, and a lot of cars have developed that way. And I think Loeb took kind of Richard's style a stage further and then influenced all the modern driving in cars. Because once you're able to do that, you can carry so much more speed, but it carries more risk. So it's being able to do it safely is the thing. Going on to the Mitsubishi, yeah, I mean, it wasn't an easy car. It had a particular style to it. And I suppose we just, you know, tried to work with engineers that we worked with. And I think that's where Richard was probably, again, ahead of his time, just relationship with engineers. So whether it was, you know, Christian Lorio at Subaru, you know, whether it was Simon Cole then at Subaru as well, whether it was Mark Amblard was the guy at Mitsubishi when we first went there. So it was always a case of working, you know, the engineer was the first relationship that Richard, probably apart from co-driver, which he probably took for granted some of the time, but engineer was the first relationship that he had to get right because that's what he needed. To get out of the car. But, you know, I remember with Tommy in Argentina one year, there was a stage, can't remember the name of it, but one of Tommy's favourite stages. And we beat him on stage. And all we could hear on the radio was lots of Finnish and quite a bit of swearing, because he knew how to swear in Finnish, and numbers and the word clicks. So we assumed he was talking about damper settings. And we got to the next service and Tommy's like, we went and did another stage before service. And Tommy blitzed everybody. Like occasionally you would get a stage where a driver takes a second a kilometre out of everybody else, all the other fastest drivers in the world. And you all like, you know, eyes open up and you go, wow, that was really something special. So then we go into service. And we're like, fair play, Tommy. He said, yeah, I was trying pretty hard in there. He said, but I adjusted the dampers beforehand and the car is now perfect. And he told the engineers, you know, I want, this is my setting. And the engineers came back and I can't remember exactly what he'd done, but he'd adjusted one side one way and the other side the other way, or it was something that wasn't quite balanced. And he said, no, we need to balance it back. And anyway, I think Tommy went on and won the rally. And they put that damper setting in on a test for him and asked him to test it blind like a few weeks later. And he came back after a few occasions and said, I can't drive that. So, you know, there's as much time in your head, or there's a lot of time in your head and your confidence, as well as, you know, car setup is very important. But if you let yourself get bogged down by that all the time, then you're never going to get anywhere. And I think the resilience that we built up by knowing that we couldn't change the Mitsubishi much. I mean, it had what they called at the time a Sprag center diff. So it was basically a clutch with an electric anti-slip device, you know, electric limited slip diff on the center diff. And the problem with that was you had to be full throttle, basically, for that to work, for that to basically, you know, tighten up and be solid. So if you were driving the car, you know, using the finesse of the throttle, it was really hard to get that to operate properly. So Richard's natural style didn't naturally suit that type of car, or the way that, you know, Mitsubishi should set that car up. Then, you know, going back to Subaru was, you know, it was like coming home in a lot of ways. You know, the car still felt, even though we were, what, 3 years on of evolution and we're into World Rally Car territory at this time, it still felt right. But then we had another situation that year in 99 where they went a couple of events in, I think, maybe after Safari. They widened the track of the car to take the full permitted width in. And in doing so, the geometry changed. And Richard just didn't like it at all. So we ended up, they called it a medium track, the setup we had. I can't remember exactly what it was, but it wasn't as wide track as Juha's car. But it had a geometry that worked much better for Richard. And then we won four events, I think, 99. And then went on 2000, did first three events, and then after Safari, before Portugal, the 2000 car came in. And that was, it's kind of Christian Lorio's first car that his first baby, as it were, first one he designed himself. And Christian had been our event engineer on the British Championship in 93. So he'd obviously been with ProDrive a while and was kind of, you know, was a car engineer, as it were, but wasn't chief designer, as it were. And he kind of took over from Lappy at that point in terms of, okay, this is, you know, freedom for Christian to express some of his crazy ideas. And he came up with the P2000 car. And I remember the first time we drove it, I think it was in Spain somewhere, and they had a 99 car and 2000 car. And with the 99 car in the spec that we would use for that type of road, 2000 car in a spec that was taken off the drawing room table, as it were, it wasn't perfected in any way. And we went, we did a time in the 99 car, got in the 2000 car, and it was, say, a 4 kilometer piece of road up the hill. So Christian said, right, guys, 4Ks up, 4Ks back, come back, I want an initial impression. So we went and we did 4Ks up and we got to the top and Richard turned to me and he said, what's time? And I told him what the time was. And I remember to this day what he said to me. He said, you're not often wrong, but that's not right. You must have done something there because it was so much quicker than 99 car. So we turned around and he facetiously said to me, make sure you get the timing right this time, as we're about to go down the hill. So we go down the hill, press the stopwatch. He's like, what time? And I told him, he said, you were right. He said, I have no idea why this car is so quick. It doesn't feel massively quick. So anyway, handbrakes around. I said, no, Christian said to go back. He said, no, I need another run. So we went up at the top of the hill again, and the time was, you know, similar. And we must have sat there for 10 or 15 minutes discussing what the car was doing, because he couldn't get his head around why it was quicker, and he needed to have that discussion and to understand it before he could go back to Christian and say, okay, this is what it's doing. This corner does this, this corner does that. Again, it was that kind of analytical relationship with an engineer that probably at that point was unusual in rallying, but very usual in racing.
You guys, you really locked into the P2000 there for a lot of the events. Like, I think he had something like 60-something quickest stage times in 2000 alone, and that was 20-odd more than the champion that year, than Marcus Granholm. So, like, the pace was obviously clear to see. The car itself was phenomenal. We've seen a good few in Ireland over the years, and of the Tour d'Or and Prezes, like, you can see the difference in pace. They're a fantastic bit of kit. So credit to Lario and the team for doing a good job on that. But I suppose you missed out in 2000. Did the fact that you didn't get to the very top in 2000, did that inspire your approach in 2001?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think we did four in a row in 2000. So we won Safari in the 99 car, then first three events in the P2000. And then we finished second in Spain to Colin. We were on Pirellis, he was in Michelin. In those days, there was a bit of an imbalance. So it was all looking good. In terms of the fastest times, we'd actually had the most fastest times in 99 as well. So 99, 2000, 2001, we had the most fastest times of anybody. For me, with hindsight, I probably wouldn't have said it at the time, the biggest mistake and the reason we lost the championship in 2000 was Finland, was chasing Marcus for a win rather than settling for second place. And again, it's a bit of a funny story, but you guys probably remember, we went off after the flying finish in the stage and big accident, cars destroyed. I go on the radio to Simon Cole, Crikey, as we called him at the time. I'm like, that's it, we're retired, we're out. And he's like, yeah, I've got your time. Just give me a shout when you're 5Ks up the road. And I'm like, no, Simon, we've crashed. He said, yeah, no, I've got your stage time. I've got your time. Because obviously we got time. And I think we'd just gone into the lead of the event with that stage time. And I said, no, Simon, we've crashed after the flying finish. The car's upside down in the trees. It's pretty destroyed. We're not going anywhere. And there's just a big, long silence. As it all kind of sunk in. And I think, like I say, if we settled for second that year, it would have made a difference, a big difference to the championship. So we end up coming to GB, and we have to win. And Marcus has to be lower than third or whatever it was. We bend a wheel bend a rear suspension on one of the first stages. We end up with a pinhole in the oil filter at one point, and the car's going on fire on road sections. You know, there was all sorts of drama, but we won. And I must admit that it's the most galling thing that I think has ever happened with me, that you've really tried your heart out and you've won the event and it's not enough and you don't win the championship. So from that perspective, yeah, I mean, it was a major thing. I don't know how it actually affected us, probably subconsciously. You know, you maybe do something different, but the start of 2001 was quite tricky because a new car right from Monte Carlo in 2001. So it came off the back of a car that Richard felt really at one in, into the four-door car, which we did the first test and we said the engine doesn't feel good. And they're like, on the dyno, it's better than last year's car. And we're like, it doesn't feel good. And we did Monte Carlo, which was a disaster for the team. I think all three cars retired, or certainly us and Marco did. We did Sweden. We did what we always do in Sweden, which is go off in the snowbank for ages and then play catch-up and set loads of fastest times. And me get frostbite in my fingers from trying to dig it out. And then we got a couple of events or three events in, and they said, we found there's an install problem with the engine, and actually in the car, it's not getting as much power as it was in the dyno. So this typical thing of, oh yeah, the drivers are just complaining because they always want more power. You know, Richard had actually picked up what was going on there. So we're kind of playing catch up a bit at that point. But the rules had changed. The points had changed. They changed from 8-6-4-3-2-1. Sorry, 10-6-4-3-2-1 to 10-8-6-5-4-3-2-1. So the benefit of winning was now 2 points over second, not 4 points like it used to be. And at that point, Richard was like, oh, right, well, I know what to do. We just got to keep bagging points. And, you know, we obviously won in New Zealand and won the championship. But in some ways, you know, and Richard said to me a couple of things, he said, it would have been quite nice if we won the championship without winning a rally. You know, and that was almost his mentality. His mentality was, he went out there and he tried to be perfect. He tried to be the best he could. And he knew if he did everything to the best of his ability, on the recce, on the test, on the rally, drove absolutely perfectly, he would be fastest. And I mean, we'd get to the end of a stage and he'd go, what's up? He said, I missed one breaking point in there, like in a 20K stage. So in his mind, it was once he'd break too early. You know, that was the kind of levels of perfection that you were dealing with. And it was just all about any opportunity to get better, any opportunity to raise that bar for himself. And in a lot of ways, beating other people wasn't the focus. It wasn't about, I'm going to go and beat Colin or beat Marcus or beat Tommy or whatever, as some of the other drivers might be. It was, I'm going to go and I'm going to drive my rally and I'm going to do it to the best of my ability. And I know if I can do that over 400 kilometers, I will win.
Looking at 2001, there's a lot of parallels to be drawn with, we'll say, 1982 in Formula One, where Keke Rosberg only won one race and won the title, same as yourselves. New Zealand was your only win, and unfortunately it turned out to be your final win. But what a way to do it. I mean, that was we've covered the New Zealand round earlier on in the series, and I think the three of us agreed that it was probably one of your finest wins. What was it like for yourselves?
I think did we drop 40 seconds in road penalties?
Yeah, that was it. There was a huge amount of tactics going on that year with all the road position kind of anomalies and stuff.
Yeah, and Colin didn't. Yeah, that's right. I can't remember when we were working out as we're going along. I mean, I think in those days, and even by that point, it got easier, but the job of the co-driver was very different than it is today. You know, back in first World Championship rallies I did, sort of early 90s, as a co-driver, you'd be lucky if you got out of the car twice a day for a pee, and that was about it. You know, and then you're obviously getting to service parks, but then you get to central service, and you know, the whole job changes. But I think one of the strengths of Richard and I's relationship was I did the majority of the testing with him. And the reason that he insisted that I did that was, his view was, there's only two of us in the car on the event, so therefore if there's somebody else who understands, and often, you know, I take the notes that I took on the test, like all the timings and the changes and everything, with me on the rally, and often he'd say, remember on the second day of the test when we tried that other damper, what were my comments? And I'd be able to say, well, you liked it, but it wasn't stable in the high speed, or, you know, whatever the thing was, but it was half a second quicker. So whether it was tires or, you know, the technical stuff, and I think I had a good understanding of the technical stuff and certainly an interest in it. from being on all the tests. But it was also the tactical stuff as well, you know. So it was a big discussion. I can't remember where we were, but you know, if we drop 10 seconds, 1 minute of road penalties, where will we be? Will that be enough? What if we drop 2 minutes? What if we drop three? We really don't want to drop any more than three. Then I was like, actually, think of this. If we drop four, we drop, you know, three or four more places, but we're still only another 10 seconds back. Then you're calculating, okay. And we worked on a rough rule of thumb of a tenth of a second per car per kilometer is what you would make back. So we did all the calculations, worked it out, like, wow, that's a no-brainer. We should definitely do that. Yeah, but it's a big risk. Yeah, it is. And we're on the phone to Crikey. Simon, can you just calculate? What do you think? Do you think we should do this? Do you think we should do that? So there was a whole lot of thought went into it. It was very literally tactical. I remember McRae came up to us at the end of the day. He came up to the end of the day. He's like, all right, Burnsy, you fucked that one. And just because he thought we'd pushed it too far. And then I think, were we back in front of him at the end of the first stage? I think we were, and in the lead by the end of the second stage of the second day. Then it was a case of try to make hay while the sun shines on the second day and push like crazy. And that's what Richard was good at. Richard was really good at knowing when to push, when not to push, when to preserve the car, when to settle for second, apart from Finland 2000. And you know, he's really good at, a really good judge of that type of thing. So we pushed on that second day, and then the last day, Colin obviously had an opportunity to come back at us. And because halfway through the second day, you then end up in that scenario. Do you keep pushing on? What's the minimum we would like in terms of a lead? Or do you start slowing down halfway through the second day to be tactical for the last day? But the last day included a forest called Maramarua, which didn't clean as much. And I think from memory, there was a couple of longer stages and then Maramarua. So we decided to push on. Lead going into the third day, I think, and then Colin went off on the third day, so it never actually came down to, he was taking time, but he wasn't taking enough. And then he went off on Ponga Coast, I think, from memory. And then it was, you know, it was relatively straightforward after that. But yeah, I mean, that's, for me, that's what rallying should be about. You know, rallying should be about endurance and tactics.
That was, you know, I suppose a textbook story from Richard and you. Like, at any stage during 2001, did it feel like all hope was lost?
There was a bit of that. Sat by the pool in San Remo with a beer, halfway through leg one, when we should have been still competing, and again, it was just, I don't know what it was about San Remo. It never really clicked with us. But we started San Remo. We had a tyre delaminate on the way to the first stage. So the tread came off it. So we had to stop and put the spare on, which was fine, no problem. And then we had another one delaminate into the stage. Carlos also had one delaminate on the road section. And Paul Hembry, the boss at Pirelli, came to us afterwards and said, you know, sorry, guys, we've screwed up here. It's obviously been a problem. But the second one, because we, and somebody put something on Twitter the other day, do you remember this corner? And it was actually the wrong corner that they put up, because there's a left-hander with a bridge and then hairpin right up the hill. And it's the first left-hander after the hairpin going up the hill, and there was a milestone or a kilometres post, I suppose it was, as it was Italy, on the outside. And we hit that and went down over like a bit of a wall. And it was one of those ones that we turned to each other as if to say, what went on there? You know, it's just not what you expected. Then we got out of the car and I'm like, Richard, come and have a look at this. And the tread was completely off the front right tire. So pretty sure that that's what, you know, I think if we hadn't had the delamination before the stage, you would have been asking yourself, you'd say, was it caused by the accident or did it cause the accident? It was one of those questions, but I think it was just too much of a coincidence. So we ended up back at the hotel in San Remo having a beer, myself and Richard and Woolsey was there, David Williams as well. And we're kind of like, is that it then? You know, are we going to manage to win this?
At that point, there was talk, just looking back at the coverage at the time and during the various magazines and papers that we've kind of accumulated over the years, was the deal to move to Peugeot for 02, was that agreed at or in principle at that time, or were you still fully committed to Subaru, that's it?
It was pretty much agreed at that point. And I think any little bit of doubt was probably put to bed in San Remo. I think we pretty much, remember we in New Zealand after the shakedown, going back to the hotel, Richard's like to Simon, our engineer, crikey, come on, come back to the hotel with us. We've got some stuff we want to discuss for you. And normally Simon would stay and do all his computer stuff and everything. And Richard's like, no, this is, I want to have a chat. So we drove, three of us drove back up to Auckland. And Richard said to Simon, he said, I'm 99.9% sure I'm going to leave the team and go to Peugeot. And Simon was like, all right. He said, I'm not surprised. I kind of saw it coming. He said, I've got some news for you guys as well. I'm leaving and I'm going to BAR. So he went into Formula One. So Simon's now one of the senior engineers in Mercedes Formula One. And then we were speaking after the rally, we're speaking to Christian Lorio, and Christian's like, I'm going to leave. I'm off. And Richard's like, well, I think we are, and I think Crikey is. And Christian's like, well, I'm definitely going. So there was kind of a, you know, three of the key players at that point, for whatever reason, had decided that they wanted to try something a bit different. So, you know, the deal still wasn't done at that point, but I think we'd probably made our minds up at that point. And then there's always, in all these deals, there's always like a moment when you're like, right, that's it. But it was probably the thing that reinforced it was definitely San Remo.
That's very interesting. And it's something that personally I hadn't heard about, the tyre issues in San Remo that actually caused the off, because looking at it from the onboard, as you say, you turn to each other and ask, what's after happening there, because it just didn't make any sense. You know, the speed wasn't crazy big or anything like that. It was strange, but it's great to hear finally 19 years later, I guess, to find out what happened. But so obviously at the time, and we've mentioned it numerous times in different episodes, the amount of hype around the championship at the time, not just in the UK but like globally, with all the various aspects, the TV coverage, the, you know, newspaper media, not just the specialist press, it was mainstream news. You had the WRC game, all this sort of stuff. What was that like for you and Richard, I suppose, especially at home, considering that you were title contenders going into the final round with Colin?
Yeah, I suppose we'd had a dry run to the year before, but it's tough, you know, home round with all that hype and media attention is tough. And you know, I remember, well, there was also a bit of legal stuff going on in the background, as it were, at that point. So our manager at the time was a guy called Julian Jacoby. Julian, he's a great guy. He actually managed Senna and Prost at the same time when they crashed into each other. So he had a huge wealth of experience. And he was walking about all rally with his briefcase. I don't know whether I had contracts or probably had two contracts, one from Subaru, one from Peugeot, and a couple of writs and high court injunctions and whatever was in it. So yeah, it was tense. You know, it was really tough. I mean, there was talk, hypothetically, when we were in the middle of the rally, of if it came to it, is it worth not winning this rally and not winning the championship in order to make a move? Because the problem we had was, when we agreed to deal with Peugeot, we didn't look like we would necessarily win the championship with Subaru. And the contract with Subaru was we had to stay if we won the championship. So there was hypothetical talk of, is it actually worth throwing this championship in the bigger picture to go and legally make a move to Peugeot? Now, at the end of the day, the conclusion was no, we wouldn't do that. But it was something you had to discuss at that point. And then obviously all the Colin Richards stuff. And, you know, I think the positives were there was a picture of a World Rally car on the front page of the Times newspaper in the UK 3 days out of four during the rally. Now, that coverage you can't get anymore. That was more coverage than Colin had got from winning in 96, more coverage than Damon Hill got for winning the Formula One championship in 95. So, I mean, WRC was definitely, you know, on the radar at that point.
I guess, you know, we've covered the GB round at this point, and we've seen what happened. Like, just to even have four guys going into the final round with a mathematical chance, admittedly in Carlos's point, but you know, it was all to play for with Tommy, yourselves, and Colin, and you would have passed Tommy on the first stage or the second. The first stage of Friday morning, and then came across Colin's car on stage four. At that point, what was the feeling like in the car? Obviously, it still had 2.5 days left to go, but did you sense it was starting to come right?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first few stages were tough. We knew what Colin was going to do, which is what he always did, which is try and get a jump on the first stage. You know, if possible, Colin, you know, if you look back some of the stage times of events, often he would take 15 or 20 seconds on the first stage and then manage it for most of the rest of the event. So we knew we couldn't allow him to do that. But we would be quite happy with one or two. And I think it's funny how I had a conversation with Nicky not that long ago, you know, within the last couple of years, just your recollection, you know, they thought they were in control. We thought we were in control. And you're in this bubble in the car and you're managing it and you've got your game plan. And you're going with it. And I think it was foggy on the first couple of stages as well. And there's a place, is it Tile on the stages? Yeah. There's a place and there's a gate that's in the road book and everything. We have it in our notes. And it's, you know, flat plus max, blah, 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 flat minus through the gate. And I'm calling the notes and I'm thinking, that was brave, Burnsy. Absolutely flat out on a flat minus through the gate. And then like a couple of seconds later, he's going, where's the gate? Where's the gate? I'm like, you've passed it. You've passed it. You know, just absolutely on the limit. And, you know, it's a tough one. It's, you know, you speak to people who haven't done it, people who rally even, who haven't, you know, gone at that speed, and you can't explain it at all. And I remember, you know, again, involved with young drivers, speaking to Elvin and Scott Martin and these guys. And they're, you know, they're in World Rally cars. They're starting to, you know, do some good speed, some good times. The odd fastest time maybe, but you're having to explain to them, you haven't said to them, guys, you don't know what it's like yet. Until you're in that championship fight or rally winning fight, you don't know what it's like. And there's not many people in the world that know what it's like. Just that kind of level of focus and commitment and just absolute shutting everything out. So it was pretty intense. And, you know, fortunately for us, it came right. I mean, I'd like to kind of sit here and say, you know, oh, of course I knew Colin was going to crash. No, we didn't know Colin was going to crash. You know, you'd probably have to say that judging by past records, it was more likely for Colin to crash than Richard, but didn't mean to say that Richard wasn't going to crash at some point. You know, and that's just the way it turned out on the day.
There's a famous onboard from McRae on the first stage that Friday morning. It's like, it kind of sums up Colin's style. You could see like how he was taking big chances, and you can see how it ended up in him ultimately him and Nicky going off the road. But you look at the stage times and compare your onboard from stage four, and the car is so much tidier. Like Richard always had, it's one thing to note, he was very rarely oversteering on corner exit. The steering wheel was nearly always straight, as straight as possible on corner exit, whereas McRae was just all over the place on that stage. Like, it was almost like a changing of the guard in a way, you know, and McAdam might have been kind of more the McRae mold as well, but Richard and you definitely ushered in a new era in the sport, definitely.
I think Reggie was very efficient, you know, in the way he used the car to turn. He used the weight transfer. He always needed the car to rotate rather than, you know, as you say, he did all his turning before the corner. And then when you were actually coming out, there was maybe a slight amount of oversteer, but not very much at all. And his aim was to have the steering wheel, front wheels, pointing straight to where he wanted to go.
Like, that's, again, as I said, and that is the way that everything has gone nowadays. Just reading back on our notes from the time, I noticed you had a couple of small incidents during the rally that actually could have, you know, cost you perhaps even the title. I think, did you go through a stage with a Maglite torch tied to your hand or something?
Yeah, two breakfasts, Breckford and Truscoid. Probably two of the most difficult stages in the dark. And Christian wouldn't let us have anything in the car that we didn't need. So if he'd known that I had that little Maglite torch in there, he would have taken it off me. I mean, literally, it was, you know, you got to run it as light as you can. And so on the job list for the service before was put the map light in, because he wouldn't let you run with the map light all day, and he wouldn't let you run with the map light on the roll cage above you. It was on the roll cage by my shoulder and then came over and pointed down, because it was too high, all 100 grams of or 80 grams or something, it was too high to have up on the roll cage up there. So, and it was a bit of a shit fight, the whole event. I say politically it was difficult. There was problems with the car. I don't think I went in the car to drive to the exit control of the service on any of the services in that rally. I walked to time control because we were always like seconds away from penalties at every service. and we got halfway down the road section to Breckford, and it started getting a bit dim. And you started getting, you know, light was going. So I just reached over to get the map light, and I was like, shit, no map light. They've forgotten to put the map light in. So we're trying to work out what to do, and I'm like, I always put new batteries in this torch for every rally. And it was just one AAA battery in one of these tiny little mag lights. And I don't think I'd ever used it on a rally, but it was always in my bag. And so I said, I know what I can do. So we found with like half a dozen tie wraps on this mag light. So I tie wrapped it to my hand, and we tried it. But first thing, I tie wrapped it to my right hand. But the problem was when I was turning pages and everything, it started shining across. So you had to cut those tie wraps off. And we're literally down to the last tie wrap at this point. And tie wrap it to the thumb on my left hand so it wouldn't blind Richard when we're doing the stage.
That's crazy. You know, obviously it shows the dedication to trying to keep the weight down, as you said, and even set their gravity down. But man, that's insane. You know, and look, fair play for the improvisation. That genuinely, if he'd went off, that could have been game over.
Well, or, you know, I mean, we could have dropped 30 seconds.
Exactly. Yeah, that's phenomenal. I mean, it's something, you know, we'd always do competing at home. You'd always put new batteries in the intercom, for example, or like you said there, if you a torch or whatever. But that's at that level, that's amazing. When you cross the line in Margam Park, I suppose, I know you've mentioned how much other stuff was going on in the background. Was it a big release, or how did it actually, did it take a while for it to kind of really sink in that you'd done it?
Yeah, I mean, it did. You know, there's an immediate reaction. You know, obviously Richard shouts, "You're the best in the world." And then there's the immediate reaction. But if you notice on the television stuff, I'm sat in the car. He's out hugging his dad and all the rest. Because, as you guys know, a rally's not over till you get to the last time control. So we're I have to get back into Cardiff, which is a bit of a shit fight at the best of times. And we're on the road section back, and I'm on the phone to Fred Gallagher, who was clerk of the course, going, "Fred, traffic's not very good." Like, "Don't worry, boys, don't worry. Don't break any rules. If you take any penalties, I'll cancel them." You know, because you've got, all of a sudden at that point, you've got a world championship riding potentially on whether you break a few traffic rules and get back on time or not. So, you know, for me, it wasn't until we got on the ramp, then it's like, okay, guys, you can take the car away now. That's fine. We're done. Job done. Well done, everybody. But up until that point, you know, it's really difficult. And then there's a guy on the motorway on the way back. There's a guy who was trying to race us on the way back. Now, that's not what you need. You've just won the world championship on stage times. You're trying to get back sensibly into Cardiff. You don't need somebody racing you. And then following us was, we're both good mates with Dario Franchitti. And Dario Marino and Mick Doohan and a couple of them were in Richard's road car, his Subaru, or it's an RB5 or whatever it was, or it wouldn't be RB5, but whatever the turbo and Brett's at the time was. So they're like coming alongside, you know, cheering and everything. And we're all like, "Oh, I just need to get back to Cardiff. Just need to get to that ramp. I'll relax when I get to that ramp."
As you said, rally's not over till the time card is handed in at the last control. And like, well, as you said, even at the finish line, you were in the car trying to just keep control of things, make sure that everything was in order, because, you know, the last thing you'd want is to throw it away at that. But no, that's phenomenal. I think looking back at the season now, and we can look at it now because it's, you know, a long time has passed. It feels like yesterday to us, but it's nearly 20 years ago. And the more you look at it, the more you really appreciate how far ahead of your time Richard and you were in your approach and stuff. You probably didn't get as much recognition at the time because the driving style wasn't as spectacular as what had gone before. But I definitely think, you know, we can see it now looking back how much of an influence it had. So that, you know, did you sense that there was a change coming, or was it just another kind of year for yourselves or what?
Yeah, I think you're so much in the bubble. That's the thing. So probably didn't, you know, maybe a little bit like yourselves, you know, looking back now, yes. At the time, didn't maybe really fully appreciate what was going on. Just went about things as, you know, as we would. And, you know, I think the that nature of it, you know, borne out by the fact that we were staying in a different hotel from the team So the night we won, because we weren't really speaking to anybody, because there was all the legal stuff going on. We went out and had a big night out. I don't remember a huge amount of, other than Richard's shirt or his T-shirt he had on. Everybody was signing things and writing things on it. And then the other funny thing of that one was, must have been, I think it was Sweden the next year. Beef came up to me and he gave me £100. And I'm like, what's that for, mate? He said, oh, you gave me £100 on the last night of GB at the party because my card wouldn't work. And I had no recollection of giving him £100. I'm like, you could easily have kept that. I would never have known about that. But then you wake up the next morning, 7 o'clock the next morning, Warren Hunt drove us up to London because we're doing some filming around Marble Arch with the car. And then the next morning, the High Court case starts. So, you know, it's pretty much bang, 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 bang. It was, it was pretty full on.
Yeah, it's a strange one. I remember just the coverage at the time, and like I've Rally Access here in front of me, and it just details all the different things that were happening the weeks following the event, and just a strange finish of the year for you guys. The move to Peugeot then for 2002 and 2003, what was that like for you guys? Like you should have won Finland really, bar the incident in Unapaya. But can you take us through just a brief kind of a summary of that?
Yeah, I think in 2002 we should have won Finland, we should have won New Zealand. Again, it wasn't unlike going to Mitsubishi when the car was a very Tommy car. You know, the car was, well, I wouldn't even say the car was a Marcus car, but Marcus suited the car and the car suited him. And again, it was very different, you know, working with a French team, completely different than working for a British team. You know, you had a problem on a test, the first thing they would do was sit down and have lunch for 2 hours and have a bottle of red wine. But in all fairness to them, they would plan out during that time how they were going to fix the problem. And then they would get on and fix it. Whereas the British teams would get stuck in about it with crowbars and hammers and all sorts of things trying to sort it out, you know, there and then. And I'm not sure actually at the end of the day which was the best approach. I know which was the most frustrating approach, and that's definitely the French approach. There was a little bit, not so much a language barrier, but a culture barrier. Again, didn't really click engineer-wise, particularly. So, you know, that was a challenge. And then probably targeted a couple of events that we would we thought that we could win that kind of suited. And Finland and New Zealand are actually fairly similar in terms of setup, but there was a active roll control that Peugeot had for the back of the car that basically, if you imagine when a car rolls, as in body roll, then the camber changes on the outside wheel. So what they were trying to do is keep the camber the same on the outside wheel, regardless of what the weight transfer was doing. So keep the contact patch the same. And we just couldn't really get on with it. And we elected not to run it in Finland and not to run it in New Zealand. And Marcus did a typical Marcus. Yeah, fine, whatever. Yeah, I'll run that. Yeah, it feels okay. You know, not really putting that much effort in the test. So I think there was probably an element of that we were more diligent during the test than Marcus was. But, you know, it was tricky. It was a tough car. And then GB that year, I mean, we ended up going off in Morgan Park, you know, literally a couple hundred yards from where we won the championship. the year before, which are quite bizarre. But Australia, I had broken three ribs in a testing accident. So I did Australia strapped up. Well, the first day of Australia strapped up and the clutch went. And then came back to the UK. And I remember the doctor saying, because we were injecting anaesthetic into my ribs in Australia. It was pretty painful. And I remember the doctor saying, do you want to do the anaesthetic injections again? And I was like, no, I'll be fine. He's like, no, I really think you need to take the painkillers, you know, get on top of it. No, no, I'll be fine. But the first service and the first day, give me what you've got. And, you know, we're getting to the end of a stage and I was saying, Richard, I'm really sorry. He's like, what are you apologizing for? I said, I'm lashing in sweat. It's not even that warm. I'm completely spaced out. I can't be reading the notes right. And he's like, no, you're absolutely perfect on the notes. So, you know, I think just the intense adrenaline of trying to overcome that pain. And then eventually, you know, we just, we went off on the outside of that corner before the gate coming into Margam, which was pretty pretty disappointing end to the year.
In 2003 then, and like again, it just shows like the competition at the time. But you guys were leading the championship for a lot of the year until, unfortunately, Richard's illness started. And that was, you know, obviously a very, very sad end to things for you guys that year. But, you know, it wasn't beyond the realms of possibility that you could have won in 2003 as well. So,
Definitely. That was the plan. But, you know, end of 2002, I mean, Richard's mum died Christmas Day 2002. So there was a whole load of things going on there as well that didn't help that whole one. But, yeah, I mean, the plan was, and it was very much the plan before we went to Peugeot. First year's a learning year. Second year, we will try and win. And you know, that's what we did. And in some years that would have been the year with the win without any wins. And we were very much on target for that. And I think for me, to lose second place to Petter in Finland was unusual. That shouldn't have happened. You know, when I can't, Loeb won, I think, in, was it Loeb won? Marcus won? Can't remember who won.
Oh, good question, was it?
We were fighting with Petter for second. Petter ended up second, we ended up third. And I remember saying to Richard's trainer afterwards, I don't know what's going on there, but something's not right. And then we had the three events really close in terms of what order was it? San Remo, Corsica, Spain. And, you know, clearly at that point, things were not right. He was in San Remo. He was complaining that he couldn't understand the notes. And I was saying, am I reading them differently? Or, you know, is there something I can do? He said, no, you're reading them fine. They just don't make sense. They don't make sense like they usually would. And then Corsica, a couple of stages, he was getting out at the end of the stage and being sick. And kind of put it down to the pressure and the fact that there was a load of events coming together. And then clearly in Spain, he wasn't right. And he did something in Spain that he never would do. We obviously went off on the last day. And he knocked to my door when we were back in the hotel. He said, I'm really feeling bad. Here's a list of things. Do you mind if I don't go to the debrief? And he would never do that or say that. You know, he would be the person who was always at the debrief. So I did the debrief for him, made his apologies in Spain. And then a week later, we had an accident on GB test. And then he went back to London that night for something he had to go back to. And then obviously the next day driving down with Marco down the motorway was when he when he collapsed.
It's just absolutely heartbreaking stuff to hear. Obviously, our condolences still to yourself after all this time. You know, it's clear how close you guys were. And Richard had a huge amount of, you know, friends in the sport as well. We've had Colin McMaster on as well, who was obviously really, really close to him as well. And, you know, to a man, everyone had so much time for him and stuff. So still, you know, but I suppose we're paying our own tribute to him here with this series, because, you know, he is the champion this year. And, you know, it is great to look back on it. And as we said, to look back now after all this time and start to really, you know, take a second look at and appreciate the change you guys made to the sport. So you've inspired, you know, the likes of Tommy to go into co-driving in the capacity he has. You know, we started competing purely because of how we got going in this era, and, you know, the amount of, I suppose, rallying we were consuming. As kids, we were only kids, like, but this had such a huge effect on us. So,
it was an amazing time, and, you know, I think everybody probably thinks they were in it at the right time in the glory days or whatever, but, you know, when you went to most world championship rallies in that era, and 6, 7, 8 people could win that rally, it was just, you know, incredible. And again, I don't think that you realize it when you're in the middle of it. You know, you don't realize anything. You're just so in that bubble. And, you know, and I, during that period, I missed both my brother's weddings. You know, I was living down south for a lot of it. I was away. I mean, the busiest year we had was 286 nights in the hotel in 1 year. You know, we were going to New Zealand to test, then coming back to do some other event, then going back out to New Zealand to do the rally. I mean, you know, BA gold card was no problem. because you were just so, not just busy time-wise, but so absolutely focused on it. And, you know, I think I was probably wasn't the nicest person to be around in those days, to be fair, and probably bit a few people's heads off, but that was just kind of what I felt I needed to do in order to be focused enough to do the job properly. And, you know, I think any relationship in the car has to be a coming together of people with the same mindset, but also people who bring arguably slightly different skills and complement each other. And I think that's where Richard and I worked. You know, I never tried to take the limelight from Richard, but I was always there to do what needed to be done, whether that was the background information or can you go to this debrief for me or what do you think about this? You know, there was never really a moment when you thought, I wish one of us was better at that than we are, because we'd be able to do it better, because there was stuff he was really good at and stuff I was really good at.
It was fascinating to look at the approach you had and the, you know, the relationship you had. It was clear from, you know, some of the onboards that if things weren't going right with the car or whatever, you know, frustration was evident in Richard, and it's obviously driven by the level of perfection you guys were trying to attain. You know, anything that got in the way of that was obviously an issue for you guys. But
I remember somebody saying to me, how do you put up with the way he treats you? And I said, well, how do you mean the way he treats me? And they said, oh, we saw on an onboard the way he was shouting at you in Sweden when you were in a snowbank. You know, and he's banging the wheel. And I say, he wasn't annoyed at me. He's annoyed at the situation. I happened to be the only other person there at the time. So, you know, I was part of the vent, as it were. But he wasn't annoyed at me. And one of the good things with Richard and I is we had this agreement that what happened in the car stayed in the car. So you could be completely honest with one another, brutally honest, or maybe even more so, have an argument, decide that, you know, whatever conclusion it was, and then when you got out of the car and closed the door, that was it. And I think at that level, you need to, or you just, you know, you can't harbor grudges or take things from one event to the other because the stakes are just too high.
Something that's always stuck in my mind was a couple of lines from Richard's book. And he was describing the relationship that the two of you had. And he said that the trust was so high that if you were on, say, on a road section, and the three cars in front of you turn right and you told them to turn left, you go left. You wouldn't, or he would go left. He wouldn't even question it, which that does speak volumes for the level of trust that you had.
But he was quite intelligent as well. So on a road section, if you turned right three times, he would say, wouldn't we have been better just turning left once? So, you know, there was a sense of humor there. And I mean, yes, it was trust, but it was mutual respect. He always said, you know, if you read the pace notes and say turn right and it ends up being over a cliff, then I would do it anyway because I believe you. But then he'd also get to the end of the stage and he'd go, you flinched in there. I said, did I? Yeah, I saw you flinch. I don't like it when you flinch. It makes me nervous when you flinch. I remember one occasion in Greece, we're coming along and there's a crest, and a long crest that you dip down after the crest, and then the road goes 90 right. But just over the top of crest, there was a junction with the road off hairpin right. So the crest, you're kind of sideways over the crest as you're braking. And I happened to look up at the wrong moment and saw the hairpin right road as we went past it. I'm like, fuck. But everything's under control, and you know, the car gets grip again, you go around the corner, there's no problem. And then the stage is like, you flinched in there. I'm like, well, I think I've got pretty good reason to.
He clearly had, obviously both of you, massive mental capacity to be able to, you know, cope with the level of detail, the pace knots, and, you know, concentrate on driving the car and that way and everything. But no, I think it ties back in again to the amount of hype around the sport at the time, that it made guys like yourselves into proper heroes for people like us. I mean, we started this podcast, and it's because of stuff we'd be talking about on the pub anyway. You know, we'd still be reminiscing about how good this era was, and you know how iconic the rallies were, the cars were, and especially the crews. So, I mean, it's been fantastic to get your insights into that time. I'm sure our listeners will agree. It's some great, fascinating stories there. So, can you just give us a little bit of insight into what you've been doing since the WRC?
Yeah, well, when it was clear that Richard was not coming back for 04 onwards, because obviously we had a contract with Subaru for 04, 05. And then the plan was, he had it all planned out, 04, 05, win the championship at least once in one of those. So the plan was to win it 03 with Peugeot, go to Subaru, win it 04 or 05, stop at the end of 05, 6 months off the start of 06, and then do Dakar 07, and then retire. That was it. He didn't want to be one of these people that went on and on and on and on. You know, he wanted at that point to be, you know, sat at home stroking the cat on the sofa or whatever. That was, you know, he'd done his thing at that point. So for me, when it was clear he wasn't coming back and Colin wasn't going to be driving in 03, I went to then chief executive of the Motorsports Association, a guy Colin Hilton, and I said, look, the sport has massively benefited from these two drivers being at the top. They're not going to be. We need to invest. You need to invest in talent coming through. And I had a couple of meetings with Colin, and eventually he agreed with me and said, yeah, you know, you're right. And I thought, well, that's fine. My job's done. Because at this point, I was spending 3 or 4 days a week with Richard, helping him through his illness. And Colin said, will you start a program for us? Which was never my intention. So I kind of stumbled into that. So fast forward, I spent a couple of years running rally program for him, and then became performance director at the Motorsport Association, so running race and rally programs, and did that up until the end of 2015. In parallel, I had been doing a couple of projects with my own company. I've got a company with a guy called Brian Cameron called ESP, Elite Sports Performance. So we had delivered some content for Pirelli Star Driver when they did that competition. So worked with Oit and Hayden and Craig and some of these guys in WRC. And then also delivered the FI Institute Young Driver Excellence Academy. So myself and Alex Virch ran that program for 5 years. Then what happened at the end of that? I had got involved a little bit with the FIA as Vice President of the World Rally Commission. And then I am now President of the Closed Road Commission for the FIA, which is the commission that looks after safety on non-circuit events, so rally, cross-country, hill climb predominantly, which means I go to all the World Council meetings now. And then I'm also involved on, I'm part of 12 of us on the International Sporting Code Commission, so the main regulations body for the FIA, so kind of involved with that. Have done, I was chairman of the stewards for WRC for 3 years as well. So kind of bits and pieces around the sport. I do interesting projects and enough to keep me interested.
Certainly haven't been idle since the WRC, as well, your WRC exploits. So I suppose just to round things off, what's your opinion on the current state of the sport versus the era when Richard and yourself were at the peak of your powers?
It's a really difficult question. It's probably the most difficult question you've asked. I think the cars are spectacular. I think the gap between R5 and WRC is probably now too big, predominantly down to the amount of aero that the WRC cars have. I think something should have been done to cap the amount of aero that they've got. The costs are too high, you know, especially in the current situation we find ourselves in now. You know, I don't know what's going to happen going forward. And I mean, I know there was a lot of talk about, you know, R5 being the top category or R5 plus or whatever. And I think it'd be amazing to see, you know, 30 or 40 top category cars go to a rally rather than 8 or 9 or whatever it is. I mean, I suppose it's good to see, obviously, you know, Elvin now getting his opportunity at Toyota. Great to see Oit winning last year. You know, Marco is Marco Martin's a good friend of mine. So I've kind of been following that journey from vicariously through Marco, and obviously worked with Oit in the early days. It's a difficult one. It's good, but is it sustainable, I suppose, is the question I would ask.
Interesting to hear you say that. We've kind of had similar thoughts, you know, ourselves regarding the gap between R5 and WRC and what could be done to, I suppose, equalize things and get that level of, as you mentioned there, 30 or 40 top category cars again. Because you look at some of the entry lists from 2001 and that era, and you had over 30 WRC cars in an event, which was like crazy. Just the sheer the amount of money in terms of just car, you know, sitting there was phenomenal, but we haven't seen it since. And I suppose this is why we keep looking back at this era. You know, it had that like golden mix of, you know, the cars were spectacular. You had huge manufacturer involvement, proper superstars for crews, and you had the coverage that was really packaging it all up and presenting it out in a really good light. So It hasn't been repeated since, I don't think.
Yeah, and I don't know if you guys sit and watch all live all the time. I mean, I don't. I think for me it's too much. You know, I don't particularly want to sit and watch all of it. And I think that the television generally has been, the highlights programs have been quite formulaic. So they don't really tell stories like they perhaps would at one point. You know, you know pretty much what's going to be in, you know, the first 15 minutes is going to be leg one, second 15 minutes is going to be leg two, leg three will be split over the last half an hour. You know, you'll have X shots of a car and then an interview, and then, you know, you can almost map it out, which for me, I think, doesn't portray the excitement of the sport. And, you know, I think the thing is, if you could bottle the anticipation of standing on a stage and hearing that last minute and a half, 2 minutes before the first car appears, it would be a best-selling product. You know, it'd be the most popular sport in the world. But how do you bottle something that's not tangible? I mean, it is just the anticipation of it. And then you see, you know, car flashing into view. And you maybe only see the car for a second or a couple of seconds. But that is just, you know, the best thing in rallying for me. And I think the other aspect is, you know, when we were competing, the Subaru was very different from the Toyota. Okay, Lancey was right at the beginning of when I was competing. But, you know, the Mitsubishi, the Subaru, the Toyota were all very different cars. And they were quite aspirational. So you wanted to go and buy a WRX or a Subaru Turbo. You know, these were probably the cars that you guys growing up wanted to actually go and drive and own. You know, does somebody want to go and buy a Fiesta or a Hyundai i20 or whatever because they've now seen rallying? I'm not sure they do. And then all the cars, you know, I keep saying, I'm sure if you painted, okay, the Toyota's a bit different, but if you painted the Fiesta and the Hyundai in the opposite colors, it would take you a minute to work out that it was the wrong car because they're all very similar. That wouldn't have happened with a Subaru, a Mitsubishi, and a Toyota. So they were very distinctive. They were very aspirational. And I think we've lost some of that at the moment.
Oh, I totally agree there. Is it like the 2001 cars, that era? Any of the WRC cars, the early 2-litre cars, they were very distinctive just purely by design alone. If they were all painted white, you'd still at a glance be able to tell which one was which, and that's interesting to hear your thoughts on the current state. But Robert, we'll wrap it up there. Actually, I had my goosebumps there for a lot of your stories, like, so to hear some of those was just fantastic. Really, really appreciate your time.
Yeah, no, it's a pleasure, and you know, thank you for inviting me. And you know, I just hope the listeners find it equally as fascinating, and it's a fitting end to your kind of 2001 year review that you're doing.